Hello and welcome to Ag PhD Radio. I am Brian Hefty along with Glenn Herz. He is our Ag PhD research lead. We are live in Fargo, North Dakota, just wrapped up an Ag PhD workshop. And during our show today, we are going to be taking questions from our audience. So even right now, for anybody in the audience, if you've got a question, just raise your hand. We'll come around to you with the mic. And then if you would, please give us your first name and maybe the state that you're from. That would be great. And then we'll get to your question. So anyway, we got a question right in the front there. We'll come, right in the middle there. All right, go ahead, sir.
David from New Salem, North Dakota. And I was just wondering, is it as important to use nitrogen stabilizers with liquid nitrogen as it is with dry?
In terms of nitrogen stabilizers, yes, it is just as important with liquid, or it's just about as important with liquid as it is with dry. I will just say, though, with dry, I worry a little bit more about the volatility side. So what they've shown, like with urea, for example, is within about 48 hours is when you're going to start losing it. So with liquid 28%, for only a portion of that, you're going to start losing it that early, and then for a bunch of that, it'll probably be a little later. So it's probably slightly more important to use it with urea if we're just talking volatility. In terms of denitrification, in terms of leaching, they both have fairly equal risk. I'm worried about both of them. But, we talked earlier today about nitrogen stabilizers in general, and we're big believers in nitrogen stabilizers. It's just you got to look at your risk factors. If you have a bunch of risk out there, you are applying these fertilizers, let's say, way in front of when you're going to use the nitrogen. You have high nitrogen prices, you're putting in high rates, all these types of things, then yes, it's usually an awfully good idea to use a stabilizer. Let's go to the next question. Go ahead there, sir.
Mike Fouquet from Maple Lake.
Yep.
I talked to you earlier, Brian, about magnesium tie-up and when's the best to apply it.
Yep.
All applied, spring applied, 2x2, however.
Yep, yes. Before the workshop even started today, he came up with a sheet of paper and gave me his question, and I was saving that for the radio show here. So when we talk about, and it was manganese is what you had written down. I think you said magnesium there, but manganese is what you said in terms of tie-up. You know, when it comes to zinc, when it comes to copper, we've really had no big issue applying zinc or copper on our soil and having them show up on our even next soil test. So if I go apply them one fall, by the time I get to the next fall, we go soil test and we have no issues, right, Glenn?
Right.
They show up pretty well.
Yes.
But manganese has been the big problem. We've done some stuff where we've put on 50 pounds of manganese sulfate even. You know, a whole bunch of manganese there, and it just isn't showing up in our soil test. And I couldn't figure out why at first until we started looking harder at soil pH. With manganese, it has a lot to do with soil pH. And also, it has something to do with the testing method you use. So, for example, if you look at AgVise, if you look at Midwest Labs, they will use what is called the DTPA test. And the reason why they use the DTPA test is they believe, and we do too, that it gives us a little bit better reading on some of these micronutrients and phosphorus when we get to mid-sixes and up for soil pH, especially when we're in the sevens for pH. We just think that's much more accurate. There are a lot of farmers in the United States today who are using a method called the Malic 3 soil test, and that Malic 3 seems to bring out a lot more manganese in the high pH soil than the DTPA. So we've sent tests in, same soil, we just have tested Malic 3 versus DTPA, and the Malic 3 might say 100 parts per million of manganese, and the DTPA says 10.
Or 2.
Or 2. And you go, what's going on here? Well, what's going on is this. There's a bunch of manganese sitting out there. The Malic 3 identified it, but the problem is it's just not very available because of our soil pH. So to your question about tie-up specifically, we don't see that much tie-up in high pH ground with zinc or with copper or with boron, but we seem to with manganese. So we're going to continue working with that and studying that in terms of, well, what do we need to do to get this problem solved? But what we've told people in the short term and what we're doing is we're just doing some banding of manganese with the planter. We've also done a little bit with the strip-till machine, but we're banding with the planter, and then we're doing some foliar feeding. So between those two things, that's certainly helping us, but what I really want to do is get my soil levels better if I can. I like having good soil levels, and then I don't have to worry so much about, oh, I got to do this with the planter, I got to foliar feed. But yeah, manganese is one we're really struggling with, and a lot of it just has to do with pH. When we get that pH down, almost anything on our farm, when we get that pH down to 6, let's say, 6.2, 6.3, we have a lot better manganese availability. So, yeah, if you've got high pH, I just encourage you to take a look at getting the pH down. If you can't get that done, band your manganese, and then you should get some decent uptake. Go ahead, Glenn.
One thing that we can mention, too, so the thing about having a Malic 3 test taken is it kind of is almost like when we look at like a P2 or a P1, P2 on a Bray test on phosphorus. That Malic 3 will tell you if you actually have some manganese in your soil, okay? When we've been looking at our Midwest Labs tests, we don't know that somewhat, or we don't believe we do, because we may get down into the sixes and our manganese tests are still low. That's when we are going to need to be adding our manganese. So that's one benefit with the Malic 3, we believe, is that at least I know that I've got something out there. Just get my pH down to where it's available.
All right. Well, once again, we are in Fargo, North Dakota. Just wrapped up an Ag PhD winter workshop. By the way, we do have a number of workshops that are coming up yet. We're getting down toward the end of the season, though. If you want to go to agphd.com, you can see our upcoming schedule. I know next week we've got a couple of workshops in Baltic, including Secrets to High Yield Fields. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Hope to see you there. Stay tuned. You are listening to Ag PhD Radio.
Your independent spirit is more rewarding than ever before. Unlike incentive programs that require growers to purchase a particular seed brand or to bundle certain products, the FMC Freedom Pass program rewards you for making the best choices for your fields. You decide what's best for your operation, from pre-plant to harvest. Your retailer and FMC take care of the rest. It's really that simple. The exclusive agronomic rewards, performance assurances, application innovations, and product financing of the FMC Freedom Pass program make it easier to protect your crops and cash flow. That's what we mean when we say we give you more freedom in the field. You'll experience more control and confidence, too. Generics and imitators can't promise that. Visit your authorized FMC retailer or FMCFreedomPass.com to calculate your potential financial incentive and learn more.
When you build with Morton Buildings, you build something that lasts. And now you can build for less during Building Value Days. If you're dreaming of a personal storage building, horse barn, farm storage, home, office, insulated workshop, or even a commercial facility, take advantage of our discounted pricing on new buildings now through February 28, 2019. So don't delay. Visit MortonBuildings.com for more information.
Want to turn smart agronomics into smart economics? Go with the all-new Grow Smart Rewards program. 1. Start with a smart agronomic plan. 2. Qualify with the purchase of a participating BASF herbicide. 3. Earn $1+ per acre for each qualifying pair-up brand. Plus, you may qualify for an additional $75 per gallon back on our industry-leading fungicides. For full program details, go to GrowSmartRewards.com. Grow smart with BASF.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ag PhD Radio. Brian Hefty here, along with Glenn Herz. He is the Ag PhD field research lead, and we appreciate Glenn joining us for some of these events. We are taking questions from our audience right after an Ag PhD workshop. We'd love to take your question. If you've got a question for us, just raise your hand, and we'll come around to you with a microphone. We got one right here. Go ahead, sir.
Tim from Upsala, Minnesota. Let's assume you're my agronomist, and I want to grow 300 bushel corn.
Okay.
So I need 335 pounds of nitrogen. My CEC is 8. How do I apply my nitrogen?
Yep, excellent question. The big thing that we're talking to people about that have light soils, when you say CEC of 8, for anybody that's not familiar with the CEC chart, we're going to call that pretty light ground. There's probably a fair amount of sand in there. We do get really concerned about putting a whole bunch of nutrients on. To his point, you know, when you're talking 300 bushel corn, yeah, it does take 336 pounds, the charts will say, of nitrogen. Not that you necessarily have to apply all that, because some will come out of the soil. But what we do want to look at is, hey, even if I'm applying 250 pounds, let's just say, for example, or 300, if you have an 8 CEC, we usually take that 8 times 10, and that tells us roughly how much nitrogen our soil can hold at any one point. So if I can only hold 80 and I got 300 to put on, I do the simple math, that tells me I got to put it on 4 different times. Now, how could I cut that down if I wanted to? We first think about rainfall. If I don't get a lot of rainfall in my area normally, I have a lot less risk that I'm going to lose that nitrogen. So right there, if I'm in a super dry area that gets, let's say, 18, 20 inches of rain normally per year, I'm going to say, all right, 80 pounds, maybe I'll push it to 90 or 100. Okay, that's the first thing. Then could I put a nitrogen stabilizer with it, maybe gain me a little bit more? So what I'm trying to do here is get my 4 trips down to, let's say, 3. Okay, and that's probably what I would do. I'd probably start the year with roughly 100 pounds. I'd come along with a side dress, an early side dress of another 100 pounds, and I'd come with 100 pounds later. My biggest fear with side dress is this, that we don't get it done early enough. We run into the problem on our farm, for example, where we'll go a month with no rain in the middle of summer. I put my nitrogen on. I get no rain. And then I don't get yield response because I got no rain and the nitrogen couldn't get into the roots or even get into the ground. So that's probably the biggest thing that I worry about with side dressing when we're talking about the Western Corn Belt. Eastern Corn Belt, no big deal. They're getting rain every 4 days. But here, we just have to be really concerned. So my point is, even though I say, yep, 80 pounds, that's all I want, I might push that a little bit, especially if I'm in the middle of the season. Okay, I just don't want to be too late. Good question. All right, let's take the next one there.
My name is Jake from Madison, Minnesota. Can you talk a little bit about planter spacing or row spacing in your soybean charts? I know some are 30-inch rows, some are twin rows.
Yep.
Some are 15 or 20. You know, with all other things being equal, are you seeing any yield difference?
Okay, this is a complicated question because, well, just like anything else in agriculture, there's good and there's bad. There are going to be trade-offs here. So what most research in the past has shown is the further north you come in the United States, the more important it is to have narrow rows. Okay, you have a shorter growing season. Now, granted, you have more sunlight in the summer, which is great, but you have a shorter growing season, and we want to try to capture as much of that sunlight as possible. Narrow rows typically are going to pay more. The downside to narrow rows is simply I've got a tighter crop canopy, and so I am at more risk for disease. So the first thing I got to think about is I want a more disease-tolerant soybean, and then in addition to that, the odds are pretty high that fungicide is going to pay better for me. Narrow rows are going to give me a better crop canopy. I'll have better weed control. Narrow rows are going to help me trap more moisture there, so I'm more drought-tolerant. And like I say, you know, if I can take disease out of it, usually we are talking a little bit more for yield. So ideally in soybeans, would I like to have a tighter row? I would. My problem on my farm is we're ending up with so much stinking disease and we're spraying fungicide 3 times and trying to find pretty good varieties on disease. We're still having some issue. And our beans are getting to be enormously huge and they're going to get taller in narrower rows typically. But we're talking about shoulder-high beans or more. And so that's very frustrating. I hope that at some point we can get some products that will shorten those beans up for us a little bit. And we're going to do more experimenting with even some of the old products that we didn't necessarily love. Like if you remember the old Harmony or Pinnacle, that would shorten beans a little bit. Cobra might shorten beans a little bit. We might do a little bit more of that stuff. Because we just have pushed that fertility thing so far, we're raising tremendous plants, but we're getting so much height. In small grain, they're using Palisade. Like if you talk to the world record wheat producer, barley producer, they're talking about palisade as a plant growth regulator to keep the plant shorter. Okay, that's awesome. But we don't have plant growth regulators, at least that I know of, in soybeans in order to do that. But yeah, as a general statement, I'm going to tell you I like soybeans for yield in narrow rows, but my problem is I'm just worried about disease. And I could almost say the same thing about population. I'd almost rather have a little higher population out there. I've got a better chance of getting past my iron deficiency chlorosis that you see a lot in these areas. I like having fairly decent population, but on the flip side, if I lower my population, then I may have a little bit more air moving through and a little bit less disease. So anyway, Glenn, any other thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know if he was just talking some stuff where we're trying to if we're talking about the first step plots that we had at the field day site, more so than anything, those guys were doing nothing more than what they're used to doing on their farms. Matt Miles down in Arkansas, they are actually putting theirs more times than not on like the beds that they've got that they grow cotton on, those sorts of things. So they're used to those sorts of things. They like it a little bit more to get some spacing between the plants. Randy Dowdy's been doing, he's very familiar with 15-inch rows. That's the thought process behind what they were doing there. But to Brian's point, our beans are getting so tall, everything that's on the farm, I mean, we're talking shoulder high, and even some of the beans were shoulder high when I harvested them. I mean, just tremendously tall plants. So we need to try and figure out how do we shorten these things out, you know, get so that we're stacking nodes a lot tighter together. That's our big issue right now.
All right, let's go to the next question here.
Jay from Wahpeton, North Dakota. Just wondering what your recommendations would be to implementing manure into your nutrient program if you have access to a lot of it, manure and compost, but you know, if you're trying to put it on going into corn ground, what do you guys normally do as a rule of thumb using the analysis of those products?
Well, the big thing is I just don't want to overdo it on nitrogen especially. So my risk for nitrogen is I can lose it, and I have leaching and groundwater concerns and all that kind of thing. But with phosphorus and potassium, I can build my soil. I have to obviously be careful there, and I have to go with my nutrient management plan. Janelle, turn these down a little bit more in my headset. With my manure management plan, that's going to be the number one thing. I can't violate that. But I'll just tell you this. If you normally put a lot of manure on and you're building up that top 6 inches where you go, ooh, boy, I'm really starting to push it, start burying some. We've injected manure clear down to 20 inches deep, if that ever becomes the issue. But I'll just say this. If, let's say, I've got enough manure for 1,000 acres and I farm 3,000 acres, what I'd rather have you do is spread that manure over more acres at a lower rate. Because what we found is once you start getting your manure levels high, in even just in one season, that salt load gets to be great. And we really worry about salt hurting things, especially if, let's say, you already have somewhat poor drainage, higher soil pH, you've already got some soil challenges. That can be a real concern. But we love manure. We love compost. We want to make that at least part of our program and supplement it with commercial fertilizer to get us, you know, where we need to go in the end. But yeah, great products. Absolutely want to use them. All right, once again, we just wrapped up an Ag PhD workshop in Fargo, North Dakota. We'll be right back with more questions from our audience.
When looking for someone to help with your risk management, a key component to look for is patience. Patience to bring you along in the process at your own speed. Patience to learn about your operation, and patience to not only discuss what strategies may be effective for your plan, but why they would be effective. That's the strength of Grain PhD. I'm Darren Hefty. When you're ready to become more engaged in your risk management, Grain PhD can assist you with that process. Visit grainphd.com to learn more.
White mold, sudden death syndrome, root rot. If you raise soybeans, it may seem like you have all the cards stacked against you when it comes to disease. But did you know there is a new cost-effective seed treatment which can help prevent all three? Heads Up Seed Treatment offers a new proactive approach for dealing with fungal and bacterial diseases. Compatible with other seed treatments, hedge your bet against disease this spring. Ask your dealer for Heads Up today. To locate a dealer, visit headsupst.com.
You need a powerful herbicide to fight the war on weeds. Bellum is Rotem North America's mesotrione herbicide, and it fights against the annual broadleaf weeds attacking your cornfields. Winning this battle means higher yields, lower cost to you, and maximized profitability. For long-lasting residual weed control, check out Evinco Vilify and our newest mix, Rixa. For application, flexibility, and season-long control, that's Evinco Vilify and Rixa, powered by Bellum. For more information, visit bellumherbicide.com. That's B-E-L-L-U-M herbicide.com.
Worried about glyphosate-resistant weeds and grasses in your corn? Unleash the power of new Impact Z herbicide and get the early post-application advantage you've been waiting for. Save $3 per acre when you combine Impact Z with a qualifying insecticide purchase. Go to buy2save3.com for details. Buy2save3 is a service mark, and Impact Z is a trademark owned by Ambac Chemical Corporation. All rights reserved. Impact Z is a restricted-use pesticide. Always read and follow label instructions.
If you're a rancher who's obsessed with keeping your pastures clear, turn to Grazon Next Herbicide. It offers superior broadleaf weed control, so instead of thinking about weeds, you can think about the money you'll save growing more grass and buying less feed. Used early in the season, Grazon Next also provides residual activity that controls newly emerged weed seedlings, giving you season-long control. Start enhancing your land while you protect it. Visit leavetheweedstous.com to learn more about Grazon Next. Always read and follow label directions.
In farming, getting things done early has a way of setting you up for success. Like using Corvus for an early season win over weeds. Corvus keeps even the toughest weeds from gaining a foothold. Multiple sites of action deliver superior control of emerged weeds. And later, Corvus reactivates with just a half inch of rain to take out any new weeds that may have sprouted. So get an early season win against weeds with Corvus for end of season rewards. Always read and follow label instructions. Corvus is a restricted use pesticide.
This one? Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. I am Brian Hefty. All right, how are we doing on our sound there, Janelle? No luck? All right, we're good? Okay, sounds good. So just having a few technical issues that we're working through here today. We are taking questions from our audience. Yeah, turn me up a little bit in my headset there if you can. Let's go back to questions from our audience. And let's see. Yep, we're going right here. Yep, go ahead.
Hi, sir. Andrew from Central Minnesota. I was wondering if you found any preferred timing or nitrogen source type for application on soybeans.
Okay, we get the question quite often, especially when guys are trying to take that next step in terms of yield on nitrogen and soybeans, in part because they look at charts like the one I'm showing you up on the screen right now. It's in your book. 100 bushel soybeans need 435 pounds of nitrogen. 435! That's a lot. Well, here's the whole thing. First of all, we got to look at how much nitrogen do we already have in our soil. Second, how much nitrogen are we going to get out of our soil through organic matter mineralization? And third, how much can that soybean plant produce itself? So if we've got good soil conditions, 6.5 pH, well-drained, good fertility levels, lots of oxygen in the soil, that soybean plant can produce an awful lot of nitrogen through nodulation. Soybean nodulation will pull nitrogen out of the air, convert it into a form the plant can use. That's awesome. So ideally, that's what we want. Get our soil working well, and adding nitrogen isn't that big a deal. If you are going to add nitrogen, what we have typically found is putting that nitrogen on, or I should even say just having extra nitrogen available when the plant starts flowering, and especially at pod fill, that's about the most important time. When you look at the charts on when that plant really needs lots of nitrogen, there you go. So how do you get it available at that point? Some people will put on ammonium sulfate earlier in the season because that will take quite a while to break down quite often. Otherwise, you could come along and side dress if you wanted to late in the season. You just have to think about what can I do so my nitrogen availability is good later in the year. When my dad first came to South Dakota. He was a farmer in Iowa. He came to South Dakota. Nobody raised beans here. And so he starts trying to raise soybeans. Yeah, you can imagine how well that went day one. But anyway, what he found pretty quickly is by putting 100 units of nitrogen on, even up front, he was gaining yield. He was gaining typically 10 bushels in yield when he first started. So I bring this up as we're in the state of North Dakota, and there are still some acres in North Dakota that have never had soybeans on them. Well, if that's the case, I'm going to tell you I wouldn't even chance it. I'd be putting some nitrogen on up front, and I might even side dress some, because the odds that your soil has enough bacteria, rhizobia bacteria, are probably pretty slim. I'm also going to look at double inoculation if it's new ground. You can have the seed treated right at your dealer with liquid, and then I'd probably throw some more dry on when I'm planting, or you know, right before I plant. So, yeah, lots of things you can try on the nitrogen, but the big thing is it's you want late season availability. Early season can help sometimes, but late season's when you really need it. All right, yep, we got our next question right there.
Say, I'm Joe from Oaks, North Dakota. My question is on ground, it's pretty high in saline.
Yep.
And you're...
How do you fix it?
Yeah. Well, what happens if you can't drain it? Because it's got a easement on it.
Yep. Then you let your brother farm it. So that's how I solve most of my problems, is I just, Darren, this ground would be perfect for you. No, that's it's a real challenge if you can't drain it. Now, when we talk, first of all, let me just say on these fish and wildlife easements, because chances are that's what we're talking about here. Back in the 50s and 60s and even early 70s, the United States government had a program where they were able to go out and buy some acres for, I shouldn't even say buy the acres, buy permanent easements on the acres, not even 99 or anything. It's permanent easements. That's forever. And what they did, most of these acres, by the way, are in South Dakota, North Dakota, and Minnesota. Or I should say Montana. South Dakota, North Dakota, and Montana. That's where most of those acres went. Anyway, they went in, and let's say it was a quarter section. It might only be 5 acres there or 10 acres that's protected. And so, yes, you might have to leave a little bit around that, but the rest of it you could drain. So that's the first thing that I want to say. The second thing is, if I can't put tile out there, how else could I do it? Well, I want to take a real hard look at doing some deep tillage. I had a farmer in central North Dakota that did a bunch of that this year, and he was showing me soil tests after. He was showing me yields before and after, and he's like, this is great. I realize it's not as good as tile, but if I can't tile, this seems to be really helping me. So I'd be taking a look at some deep tillage. I'm not a real huge believer most of the time with these C-shanks going deep and rolling the soil. I would take a look at maybe a straight shank, narrow point, and just try to make some slices through the soil. And that, with rainfall, see, keep in mind, saline's leachable. So we can, if we can leach that down, push down through any of the soil compaction layers, now we can start to flush some of those away. So that might help. Also, I would take a look at what are your soil levels for calcium. If you have good calcium levels in the soil, then you have better soil porosity and you get better drainage going down. Finally, I just say if you're really fighting it and you're just not getting anywhere, maybe you look at either barley or maybe CRP for 10 years or something like that. Get it out of production for a while. Hopefully, you know, some of those things correct themselves with a permanent crop being raised on there. And then maybe you can go back to row crop farming here in 10 years or something. Obviously, that's very worst case scenario. But yeah, I'd look real hard, first of all, at how many acres are actually protected by that wetland easement. Because for a lot of guys, when they start looking into it, they figure out, oh my goodness, I didn't realize only 5 acres was protected out of a quarter, but that was pretty common. So that's what I look at first. All right. Yep, got our next question right here.
Okay, East Central North Dakota this year had a train wreck at harvest time. Nobody got anything worked in their ground. The fields were all froze up by the time we got anything off the field.
Right.
What would be your call would be on, like, putting corn on soybean ground to go out and apply fertilizer, work it in with a field cultivator or just vertical till it? What would be your selection?
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm going to do a lot of praying for a super dry spring. So if we can get that, that'd be amazing, wouldn't it? That really would give us a lot more options. The problem is we just don't get a dry spring very often, especially when we went into the winter almost completely saturated. So I'm not counting on that. So in lieu of that, we're going to have a lot of guys that are going to end up putting more fertilizer on with a planter, trying to do some no-till stuff. In terms of tillage in the spring, we worry an awful lot about disking and heavy tillage, so we're going to see a lot more people doing lighter tillage, running out there with some type of coulter-type machine, so we're not creating crazy amounts of compaction. Now, you know, the problem with doing any deep tillage, let's say we've got big ruts, and we go, well, we got to fix those. By the time that gets really fit, we could have planted the rest of the field maybe 2-3 weeks earlier. And that's one of my biggest fears with this thing. So there are always these trade-offs in agriculture. We don't necessarily know what the weather is going to do even next week. So I'm guessing, okay, should I plant most of the field? Should I mud a little bit in, just get through this area? Or do I wait 3 days and hope it doesn't rain and then go? But yeah, if it's me, and I'll just tell you, we have some of the exact same situation. It was this was the first year where we had lined up a source for compost for probably 1,500 acres on our farm. And I thought, oh, this is going to be great. We'll get, you know, some of these jobs done, but we're not going to work the ground and do the final jobs till the compost gets spread. Well, the compost didn't get spread, so we didn't get the final work done. So now we got a whole bunch of ground that I really want to work. And so honestly, I'm hoping it dries out enough so we can go do that work in the spring, but it's going to be a different piece of equipment instead of a disc or a chisel plow or something like that. And in terms of how we get the fertility on, we're going to run on a bunch of acres with a strip till machine. Because I don't want to put 20 gallons of stuff on with the planter. I want to go with a strip till machine, and we'll put some liquid on just right in the row. We'll probably cut our rates a little bit this year and just try to survive this year because, you know, we're just really behind the eight ball. Well, once again, we just wrapped up an Ag PhD workshop here in Fargo, North Dakota. You can check out agphd.com for more upcoming workshops. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with more questions from our audience.
Your grain bin fans can cost you a lot. High electric bills from running when conditions are not ideal, shrinkage from overdried grain, and spoiled grain all take money out of your pocket. With the Steps GMS app temperature humidity switch, get your bin fans to start making you money. Only run vans when the conditions are right. Eliminate shrink and spoilage in your bins. Deliver grain in top condition at market moisture. When every dollar counts, you need Steps GMS. Contact us today at stepsgms.com.
Give your corn a strong defense against stress throughout the season with MycoApply EndoPrime SC. MycoApply EndoPrime SC uses four specially selected species of mycorrhizal fungi to protect your crop against stress. That means more access to water and key micronutrients while building a healthy soil structure for stronger crops for years to come. Stronger corn starts beneath the surface. Learn more about MycoApply EndoPrime SC at EndoPrimeCorn.com. Always read and follow label instructions.
Want to cut production costs without losing yield? Brian Ryberg from Buffalo Lake, Minnesota has done just that. Here's his story.
We began using a soil warrior on our farm fall of 2014. We've seen many benefits from better water infiltration, a lot less hours on equipment, fuel, able to reduce our fertilizer side. So it's really simplified our operation.
See what makes Soil Warrior different and better at soilwarrior.com.
High-yield corn growers know that feeding the crop and soil are keys to maximizing yield potential. Nutex EDA and Reverb are specifically formulated to help manage limiting factors associated with today's farming conditions. Nutex EDA works within the plant to support nutrient mobility and utilization. Reverb focuses on the soil, providing beneficial trace elements which help condition the root zone for optimal microbial activity. Low use rates and superb tank mix compatibility make Nutex EDA and Reverb no-brainers in the high-yield grower toolbox.
A pasture should have two things, grass and cattle. No weeds, no brush. That's why Chaparral Herbicide offers the broadest spectrum weed control available. It controls weeds other products can miss, like buckbrush and Canada thistle. And less weeds and brush in your pastures means more forage, so you spend less on feed. Chaparral also suppresses seed heads, lessening the effects of fescue toxicosis, all while providing season-long residual control. Visit noweedsnobrush.com today and learn more about Chaparral.
In farming, there's a lot of variables out of our control. Don't let fertility be one of them. Let the experts at AgroLiquid move you closer to your bullseye. It's true. AgroLiquid fertilizers are formulated to keep nutrients available to your crop, and they have unmatched compatibility with other nutrients and crop protection products, which makes application more efficient than ever. But we also have the best people in the field, ready to talk about your operation, your goals. Go to agroliquid.com to move you closer to your target.
Thanks for listening today to Ag PhD Radio. Brian Hefty here, live in Fargo, North Dakota, right after an Ag PhD 101 Ways to Cut Farm Expenses workshop. I'm joined by Glenn Herz. He is our Ag PhD research lead. We're taking questions from our audience, and let's see, where are we at with the next question right here? Yep, right in front. All right. Yep, we got the next question right here. Go ahead there, sir.
Yes, Randy from Wahpeton, North Dakota area, and we raise sugar beets, and as a result, we have a lot of truck traffic on our headlands.
Yep.
And our yield maps always show the headlands and edges of the field way down in yield.
Yes.
Half or less.
Yep.
Wondering what your suggestion might be that we do.
Well, the two biggest things that we typically talk about are things I've already mentioned here, and it's drainage, number one. And, you know, we've worked with a lot of farmers right in your area putting more tile in. So that's number one. And number two is, what's your calcium percentage? In a lot of your soils right around you, you have very high magnesium. And when you see your magnesium at 30, 40, sometimes 50%, that tells you that you're going to have a super tight, poorly drained, easily compacted soil. So over time, if we can, what we would like to do is we want to first get drain tile in there. We then want to start addressing how do we get the calcium levels up and flush some of that magnesium out. A lot of people are using gypsum to do that. So when you throw gypsum out there, the calcium is replacing the magnesium. The magnesium is binding in many cases with the sulfate. Magnesium sulfate is otherwise known as Epsom salts. Epsom salts are leachable. So once you get that drainage through natural rainfall, you're going to start changing those ratios a little bit. And here's the thing I'll tell you. With tile, you're probably going to put the tile in if you don't have it already, and you're going to go, oh my gosh, this is amazing. Why didn't we do this years earlier? Then you're going to start with the gypsum thing, and you're going to go, well, it's helping a little bit, but, you know, I'm spending some dollars here, and it's slow. It's getting there. That's kind of the way it's going to be. It's just going to take time, but let's put it this way. You know, I think an awful lot about, okay, I've got maybe, let's call it 15, 20 years left that I'm going to be farming on our ground. In that 15 or 20 years, I'd like to make this ground much better for the next generation that farms it, whether it's my kids, Darren's kids, whoever, whatever. I'm just trying to make it better for them. So there are a lot of things where if my money I'm going to spend on gypsum, even if it breaks even for me in the short term, I know there's a long-term benefit to that if I can get that drainage better. Because then when I'm out there with those trucks and I've got better drainage, I don't heavily compact the soil as much. So I'm not saying it's going to totally fix your problem. You know what the answer to totally fix the problem is keep the trucks off the field, but we can't do that, okay? So, you know, we just want to make it as good as possible for when the trucks are out there. Now, the other thing with those trucks, you know, let's think about what did we do with our tractors to reduce soil compaction? We added more tires. We started to look at how about the inflation of the tires. We did tracks. You know, I'm not saying instantly we're going to do those things, but I'm just saying in the long term, there might be some new technology that comes along that helps lower the level of compaction with a truck that we might bring out in the field. So when we see any of that kind of stuff come in the future, you're the ideal candidate for somebody who needs to be trying that. But yes, we don't raise sugar beets, but we occasionally will have our trucks in the field too. And it's concerning for me, just like it is for you. But if we can fix the drainage, change our calcium magnesium thing so we have less magnesium, more calcium, we have a more porous soil, the water will drain through, we're in much better shape. Yep, good question. All right. Yep, got another one right here.
Edwin from Hankinson, North Dakota. You work with guys from Virginia and Arkansas yep. and Carolinas. I'm wondering how well their methods translate to South Dakota. Another question is, there must be the Hefties or high yield farmers, I believe. There must you must know guys from Beersford, Alcester. What kind of yields are they getting? What are they doing?
Sure. Okay, so first of all, if you're not familiar with Beersford and Alcester, those are towns that are roughly an hour south of where we farm. So I think his question is just even in our region, what are high-yield farmers doing in our region? So let me just first say, and I can, Glenn, you can chime in too on any of this, but there are many of the concepts and ideas that the high-yield farmers will have that actually work pretty well. So I'll just give you two specifics going each way. One thing they learned from us, one thing I learned from them. First year with Randy Dowdy, or maybe it's the second year, I threw on like $50 worth of manganese on one of my high-yield plots. Dowdy probably spent $15, and Dowdy had higher levels of manganese in the plant all season long. And I go, doggone it, how did he do this? I spent way three times the money, and he got the manganese into the plant. Well, how he had, I did it with dry manganese sulfate, but I had a bunch of tie-up because my pH was high. For him, he did liquid manganese chelate with the planter at planting time, and then he did some foliar. So that's where a little earlier today I answered this question about manganese and how we're going to get that manganese out there, and I said I'd probably ban some with the planter. Learned that from Dowdy. On the flip side, first year, Dowdy and Hula and Stephen Albrecht from Texas. Those are the only three guys in the history of the world that have ever raised 500 bushel corn. So they're all fantastic farmers. And, obviously they're doing a lot of things right. But I talked to Glenn. I was upset because I'm like, Glenn, why are we not getting these plots planted? We've already planted my whole field right behind the field day site. Why are these plots not planted? And he goes, well, Brian, I don't think it's fair that you should plant your high-yield plot before these other guys do. And I said, well, what are they waiting for? And he goes, soil temperature. They want a warmer soil temp. And I go, okay, what soil temp do they want? And Glenn says, well, they're debating between 56 and 57 degrees. And I just started laughing, and I'm like, well, I'd love to have that, Glenn, but I don't want to plant my corn in June. Well, anyway, it ended up being May 23rd. It was a full month later than the whole field behind. My whole field average on almost a quarter section behind was higher than any of the high-yield plots that year. And the guys obviously spent more money, did more things, everything else. Late planting kills you. You cannot wait for 56 degree or 57 degree soil temp in North Dakota or South Dakota. It will not work. But when we're out there planting, and I have no issue planting corn in its 42, 45 degree soil temps, it's fine, no problem. If you do some other things, you have to have fantastic seed treatment. You want to put down, some insecticide, probably some fungicide in furrow. I mean, just some other things. So we have to farm in a little different way than they would. Down there, they can wait and the soil warms up. And I agree. I'd love to have that soil temp warm. It's just our odds are stacked against us, and our growing season just isn't long enough if we wait for that. So those are, like I say, just a couple of examples from the high-yield guys. In terms of farmers in our region and what they're doing to increase yield, it's some of the same things we've talked about today. Drainage is number one. You can hear almost every high-yield farmer now around us say, man, I'm so happy I got tile in. Right. That's helped us tremendously, right, Glenn?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
On top of that,
have that.
Yep, then it's the fertility piece, and it's how guys are doing fertility. And there isn't just one way to do fertility, because look at some of the high-yield guys. Some are doing strip-till. Some are doing broadcast and conventional till. Some are doing no-till. I mean, there are a lot of different ways you can get to high yield and change your fertility program, but the point is you got to have ample nutrients available at about all points during the season and soil balance. So I'd say more than anything, the high-yield guys around the country and the high-yield guys in our region are now not just looking at N, P, and K. They're talking a lot about sulfur and a lot about some of these micronutrients, wouldn't you say?
Absolutely. Another thing that I would say that is different for these guys, some of them, yes, they have RCECs and whatnot in our soils. They've got that heavy clay as well, but they've also got lighter soils. So I think the thing that we're learning as much from them as they are from us and what we see, what they can do, they have the ability to move nutrients in through the soil profile. But the interesting thing that we're seeing is when they bring those up here, how long it takes
yep.
in our soils for these things to move. And that's helping and, all of us.
Yep, because we're cold and heavy ground and a lot less rainfall.
Right, yep. So, I mean, they've got water to help move it in most cases. They've got a lot more heat. They've got a lot more rain. We just don't have that ability. So we're trying to do things. We have to do things slightly earlier because our soils are that much heavier.
All right. Well, again, we are taking questions from our audience here right after an Ag PhD workshop. We've got a few Ag PhD workshops coming up yet this season. If you want to go to agphd.com, you can learn more about that. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
What do you think of when you hear Palmer Amaranth or water hemp? If you use Fierce herbicide in your soybean field, you don't have to think about them at all. With two effective modes of action and up to 8 weeks of residual control, Fierce takes on even the toughest weeds like water hemp and Palmer Amaranth. Take control of your soybean field and get rewarded with Roundup Ready Plus when you choose the proven power of Fierce herbicide. Talk to your local retailer today to put Fierce to work in your fields. Always read and follow label directions.
Ideal for herbicide applications, the Ultra Low Drift's large air inducted droplets were designed to eliminate driftable fines without sacrificing coverage. Its thick three-dimensional pattern creates multiple angles for the spray to cover the target. Hypro, helping you spray better.
Interested in strip tillage? You should know about the Soil Warrior from ETS. With one-pass efficiency, optimized nutrient placement, and reduced production costs for higher profitability, the Soil Warrior brings the future to your farm. Visit SoilWarrior.com to learn more.
One year it could be moisture stress, another Pythium or nematodes. So you need your soybeans to rise ready for whatever the season holds. Now one simple decision provides coverage on four fronts. The Acceleron portfolio, fungicides, insecticides, bioenhancers, and an industry-leading nematicide that strikes where nematodes attack. This season, rise stronger with Acceleron seed treatment products. Learn more at AcceleronSAS.com/riseready. Performance may vary. It's important to use proper PPE when handling treated seed.
No secrets here. We all know, regardless of the markets, balanced crop nutrition pays. Agro-liquid fertilizers have the research, technology, and products you need to grow a great crop. We also have an outstanding team of field agronomists ready to help you determine the best use of your fertilizer dollar. Agro-liquid can help you maximize your yield potential effectively and economically. Visit agroliquid.com to find a dealer near you.
When you build with Morton Buildings, you build something that lasts. And now you can build for less during Building Value Days. If you're dreaming of a personal storage building, horse barn, farm storage, home, office, insulated workshop, or even a commercial facility, take advantage of our discounted pricing on new buildings now through February 28, 2019. So don't delay. Visit MortonBuildings.com for more information.
Are you frustrated with white mold showing up year after year in your soybeans? If you have tried fungicide applications and are still losing yield to white mold, now is the time to ask your seed dealer about Heads Up Plant Protectant. Heads Up is the first EPA-registered seed treatment for the prevention of white mold in soybeans and pulse crops. The first line of defense on your farm against white mold now starts with the right seed treatment package. Locate a Heads Up dealer near you by visiting headsupst.com today.
Welcome back to Ag PhD Radio. Brian Hefty here, along with Ag PhD Research Lead Glenn Herz. We are taking questions right after an Ag PhD workshop. One of the things, we've been talking a little about soybeans and yield today, too. And, you know, Glenn, I think you got the opportunity this year to work with Doug Van Dyne a little bit. He is now the state record holder in South Dakota. And what was his soybean yield?
113.9.
Yeah. Right, yeah, but I just remember talking to you and Rob Fritz, they were mad because you didn't pick the right spot in the field. You could have had over 120.
Yeah, we had some areas in there where we went 122, 123. Yep. The entire field was, I believe, it was right at 90 acres, and the entire field ran 98 bushel.
Yep, that's pretty awesome. I bring this up because we were talking about row spacing a little earlier. Mm-hmm. 30-inch rows?
30-inch rows,
yep,
30 yeah.
30-inch rows.
Yep.
All right, let's get to our next question here in the audience.
Milo from Portland, North Dakota.
Any thoughts on specific brands or types of 2x2 applicators for our planter?
Well, let's talk about types first. So I know this is one of the things we've been doing a lot of work with Randy Doughty here for the last couple of years, and he's been pushing Glenn to say, all right, even Glenn, like on your research planter, you got 2x2 on both sides, which I like, he says, and you know a lot of these other high-yield guys want to see it on both sides, so you get good root development on both sides, and also, obviously, you can safen that fertilizer by splitting it. You have half on each side. But he said, Glenn, you got to get it off the row unit because the problem is if your coulter causes your row unit to adjust at all, well, then theoretically your seed placement could move a little bit, and I want absolute perfect seed depth and consistent seed depth all the way. So that's the first thing that a lot of the high-yield guys are going to talk about is get the coulters off the row unit.
Right. I have looked at Yetter, Bandit, Conceal, Fast Track, Furrow Jet, everything. Which one's the best? I can't tell you which one would be the best right now. I like a lot of them. I like a lot of different things that each one has. But to that point, like Brian said, once we start to compromise seed depth, I don't want to compromise seed depth, however. So the benefit that I would gain by having fertility on both sides of the row, once you compromise seed depth and you can't hold that, hydraulic downforce can help you obtain that somewhat. But I've literally done plots where I've been out in no-till fields where the cattle are still out in the field. So you got to have some downforce there to keep it, you know, to keep that row unit there. Those are the big things. I like the 2x2 system. Where I'm really starting to see things when we do research is the fact that we can put a little bit of nitrogen off to the side of the row and have an early source of nitrogen there. In areas where fertility, you know, like what we were using strip till, if we've got high fertility rates there already, we probably don't see as much benefit because we don't need to put that much P and K off to the sides of the row. We can do it with just a regular in-furrow, put a little bit of pop-up with it. The plant gets growing. It hits that strip-till zone or whatnot. We've seen very good that way. So it all depends, that I believe, on how you are applying your fertility. Okay? From the standpoint of which one is best, the biggest thing that I can say is make sure if you're going to put it in a true 2x2, if you're going to just go out there and put phosphorus and it's hitting that top inch or so on top of the ground, you're wasting your money because phosphorus will not move in the soil profile. If you want to get your phosphorus to move or to use that the best that you can, that's got to get into the, you know, down into the root zone. So that's where I would go with that. To flat out say, which one am I going to pick right now? I really can't say that. I've got Yetters on the one that I use, and that's only because that's the one we put on. So,
all right. Let's see. Yep, we got our next question in the back. Go ahead, sir.
Charles from Oaks, North Dakota. Heads Up seed treatment for soybeans claims to help fight against white mold.
Yep.
Do you have any experience with that product?
Yes. Go ahead.
Yeah. So we've looked at Heads Up. It's another tool. Okay? I look at it that way. It's very inexpensive. You can add it to the seed treatment that you're putting on. That's one way to look at it. Is it going to cure white mold for you? No. Is it going to help? Yes. What we're starting to see with it as well, once we get into northwest Iowa and even southeast South Dakota, we're starting to see SDS. We're seeing a little bit of suppression there as well. But it's a product that's been out for quite some time, and yeah, it's just another tool,
well,
I think.
Yeah, it is, but here's the whole thing. We have to be realistic with our expectations, too, when mm-hmm. we're only going to spend $2 an acre.
Right.
So when I've only spent two, and let's say, I mean, even in your research, what were you gaining? A couple bushels?
Yeah,
couple
we can
bushels?
Gain. Yeah, we've seen a couple bushels.
Right.
So, I mean.
So if you gain, let's say you gain 2 bushels at $8 beans, that's $16 from a $2 investment. Is that worth it? Sounds pretty good to me. But if, like on our farm, okay, I had some spots, not this last year, but 2 years ago, I had some spots where I lost 70 bushels in spots
right.
because of white mold. Okay, is it going to give me 70 bushels? No. So I'm just trying to say, if you're looking at something for a decent return on investment, we think that's absolutely worth trying. Our research has shown that. But if you think it's going to solve all your problems, no, it's just one of the steps you need to take to gain back all those bushels if you've got severe white mold areas.
Right.
Yep.
Yep.
All right. Got the next one right here. Go ahead, sir.
This is Tom from Earhart, Minnesota. I had a question. There's so much controversy, and you just brought up phosphate.
Yep.
Okay, I'm planting a no-till about 300-plus acres of beans because the ground ain't worked.
Okay.
I have single-disc openers. I could put fertilizer 2 inches, 3, 4 inches down,
yep.
But the agronomist I've been working with says I'm better off to broadcast it because the majority of soybean roots are in the top inch of soil. So is that true or false?
That's false. That's absolutely false.
Yep.
That's absolutely false.
Right.
So there are... I'll talk about a couple of things here with phosphorus. If you and we've had this question come up a lot, and I apologize. I should have even mentioned this earlier because one of the questions was, okay, what are we going to change this spring? How are we going to do stuff this spring? There's no possible chance in the world I'm going to go broadcast a bunch of phosphorus and not work it in. Okay, if I'm going to broadcast it, it is getting worked in because otherwise it's going to lay on the soil surface. And here's my risk, soil erosion. If I have any soil erosion, the stuff blows, because of rain it moves, whatever. It's not just the soil that moves, now my phosphorus moves. And phosphorus is the number one fresh water quality issue we have, you know, for contamination in the country today. It's a big deal. Same thing in Canada. Phosphate is a big concern. So we want that phosphorus down in the ground, number one, to protect it. Number two, in terms of where are those plant roots, soybeans get planted at, call it an inch deep. Okay. Where do soybean roots come out? Corn roots, the main roots come out above the corn seed. The main roots on soybeans, it's going to be below that where that seed is planted. So are there going to be some tiny little bit of roots in the top inch? Tiny, tiny, tiny amount, not much. So most of the roots are going to be going down. And I want that phosphorus absolutely down in the soil. That will be much better for you. If you're laying that phosphorus on up above, somebody's going to get that advantage in the future. It's not going to be you this year. Your plants are not going to recover. They might recover 1% of it, but to think they're going to get more than that, no possible chance. All right, go ahead, sir.
Yeah, you were saying phosphorus doesn't move.
Yep.
Well, it must move a little bit. We've been broadcasting phosphorus on alfalfa for years, and we do get a response. So it's got to move an inch, or else alfalfa has roots on top. I don't know what the answer is, but we definitely get a response.
It doesn't move much. I know that. And also, anytime you do anything out in that field, you can move stuff down. Earthworms can move a little bit down. Anytime you drive across the field, you can move a little bit down. But my whole point is this. It's not going way in where a lot of the roots are at. And what we talk about all the time here at Ag PhD is, I don't care necessarily what I spend, but what I spend, I want to have that give me the best return on investment that's possible. And I'm just saying, if I lay my phosphorus on the soil surface, it's much more at risk to harming the environment, number one. And number two, I'm not going to recover that very quickly. Eventually, I can get some of that. But if you soil test and you soil test every 1 inch going down, I can promise you, if you've broadcast for years and not work it in, that 1 inch is way loaded up. So you think about, okay, where should I best invest my dollars? It's putting it down a little bit deeper, and you probably get a little bit better return going forward. Well, we hope you've enjoyed our show today. I just want to say thanks to our production staff and everybody who asked their questions. And thanks to you for listening. And be sure to join us again each weekday for more Ag PhD Radio.